Well, welcome, everybody, and I'm sorry that we kept you waiting for so long, but these visits are always very tight, and the traffic apparently was terrible. First of all, I just wanted to say how happy we are to have Michael Steiner. This is the first big public event of our Southeast Europe Faculty Development Programme, which is jointly funded by the Open Society Institute and the Foreign Office. And it involves bringing fellows to the LSE from all over the region, including Kosovo. So this is a really nice event to start with. And I'm very happy to have Michael Steiner here, who, as you all know, is the UN representative in Kosovo. He's had a very distinguished career. I met him many years ago when he was deputy high representative in Bosnia. And I remember it very well because he was one of the very first officials with whom one could really engage in a serious discussion. And I think he left a very important legacy in Bosnia, particularly in relation to the refugees and displaced persons. He's also been the foreign and security policy advisor of Gerhard Schröder, and so we couldn't have a better speaker to talk about. I think his title, we gave it the future of Kosovo, his title was For Example Kosovo. And just one other thing is, he says, we asked him to do a nice, normal academic length. He's not used to speaking so long, but I'm sure it'll be interesting. So I'll hand over to him.
Well, you have asked for it. So excuse me for coming late. It was very tight. We left this morning in Pristina and had one event here, and we rushed through, so it's just as you said, things are tight, so excuse us for that. Ladies and gentlemen, we've come a long way since the best advice for keeping the peace was Basil Faltey's order to Polly and Manuel: don't mention the war. The years since the end of the Cold War have not seen a general outbreak of peace. Today, the world is no longer menaced by a clash of superpowers. Instead, it is threatened by failed states collapsing into internal ethnic conflict, anarchy, and warlordism. The vast majority of armed conflicts in the past decade or so, averaging 28 a year, have been internal. In response to this epidemic, the international community has become increasingly involved in large-scale peace operations. Since its founding in 1945, the United Nations has embarked on 54 such operations. Of these, 41 began after 1988, and 15 are still underway. Today, the weapon inspectors have just reported to the UN Security Council on their findings in Iraq. We all know what is at stake. As the representative of the Secretary General in Kosovo, I have the privilege of presiding over the largest UN peacekeeping enterprise ever mounted. UNMIK has undertaken a far more ambitious challenge than most previous missions: to lay the foundation of future peace. Our mandate has three parts. First, it had to administer Kosovo. Second, it had to create the institutions and other conditions necessary for Kosovo to exercise substantial self-government. Kosovo also has a special challenge. For Bosnia, Dayton provided a peace treaty. In Kosovo, though, UN Security Council Resolution 1244 leaves unresolved the very cause of the conflict: Kosovo's status. Therefore, UNMIK's third task will be to facilitate a political process to determine Kosovo's final status once the time is ripe. Our work in the Balkans is far from over, but we have already learned invaluable lessons from it. The first lesson is that peace building is hard. Indeed, winning the peace tests our resolve and ingenuity even more profoundly than achieving a military victory. But we have also learned that it is possible. When UNMIG first arrived in Kosovo in June of 1999, it found a society in chaos. There was no government, no laws. The physical infrastructure had mostly collapsed. Into this disordered environment, some 900,000 Kosovo Albanians who had fled Serbian security forces returned with unprecedented speed. But the challenge was more complex. Therefore, UNMIG organized itself into four pillars. Pillar one has created a multinational UN police force and a multi-ethnic Kosovo police service that will eventually replace the international police. We have also created a judicial system from the ground up. Pillar two first managed all of Kosovo's public services. Since transferring authority in many areas, it is now scaling down and playing a more advisory role. Pillar three, the OSCE, does democratization and elections. And finally, the EU, as pillar four, took responsibility for rebuilding physical infrastructure and is now helping to create the foundation for an EU-compatible economy. KFOR, a joint NATO command that includes troops from 37 countries, has responsibility for maintaining a secure and stable environment. The civil mission would not have a chance without KFOR. Thanks to effective coordination, KFOR has not agonized over mission creep in the way KFOR in Bosnia often did in the beginning. To fill the administrative vacuum after the war, UNMIG first created joint administrative structures. Later, in 2001, UNMIG and Kosovo representatives collaborated in drafting a constitutional framework as the basis for provisional institutions of self-government. Kosovo-wide elections organized by the OSCE created a multi-ethnic assembly and government. The government has 11 ministries, including finance, education, health, transport, and social welfare. Two sets of municipal elections also yielded multi-ethnic municipal assemblies across Kosovo. Despite substantial continuing shortcomings, especially with multi-ethnicity, UNMIG is well on its way to fulfilling its mandate to equip Kosovo with the institution it needs to exercise substantial autonomy and to set it on the way to Europe. The key to these achievements was not just generous resources committed, over 3 billion euro in civilian aid, but applying principles we had learned in previous peace-building experiences, especially Bosnia. In Kosovo, we have still learned more, giving us reason to hope that future peace operations will be even more efficient. Ladies and gentlemen, this evening I would like to focus on seven principles that Bosnia and Kosovo have taught us are essential to the success of peace-building efforts anywhere. The first five of these principles are: first, begin with a clear mandate. Second, match the mandate with the means to achieve it. Third, get it right from the beginning. Fourth, learn as you go. Fifth, finish what you start. These principles may be challenging to implement, but they don't pose any philosophical problems. The last two principles, on the other hand, pit the hard lessons of experience against some of our most cherished political notions. But let us first consider the uncontroversial ones. One, begin with a clear mandate. A peace operation has to start with a clear set of objectives. This may seem obvious, but even in recent missions, this elementary principle had been ignored. When we hammered out the Dayton Peace Agreement, our main aim was to end the fighting in Bosnia, basically to have a lasting ceasefire agreement. I remember that creating the Office of the High Representative was almost an afterthought. Especially in the early days, this lack of clarity created a great deal of confusion about which of the many organizations was responsible for what, and this undermined the efficiency of our international engagement. A mission's objectives also have to be realistic, both in terms of what the local population wants and what can actually be achieved. In Kosovo, our aim is not nation building, but institution building. We are fostering institutions and attitudes that will be able to build themselves. This doesn't mean cloning EU societies. In Kosovo, we are aiming at achieving fundamental standards that apply to all stable and functioning societies. In Bosnia, although the High Representative is clearly the most senior international official, the various international organizations have been quasi-autonomous. I remember all too well how much we suffered from the fact that in the beginning there was no coordinated decision-making process. This structure made it difficult for the international community to coordinate its own efforts, much less anyone else's. In Kosovo, at the insistence of Kofi Annan, UNMIK created, on the lessons learned in Bosnia, and built a new kind of structure. It created the four pillars I've mentioned, each with a well-defined mandate, and all of them subordinate to the overall authority of the Special Representative of the Secretary General. Although still imperfect, I think all observers agree that, thanks to Kofi Annan, this structure has resulted in a dramatically improved level of coordination among international actors. Two, match the mandate with the means to achieve it. If you are given a far-reaching mandate, you must also be given the capacity to follow through. This applies both to legal powers and authority and to human and physical resources. First and foremost, it is essential to establish security and the rule of law, the very basis of all other progress. Courts need the authority and resources to dispense justice. Police needs the authority and resources to enforce it. The massacre at Srebrenica is perhaps recent history's most powerful example of noble aims not matched by the means needed to achieve it. Peacekeepers making a promise that they weren't given the means to keep contributed to the death of over 7,000 people. Now, a Kosovo success story. The Kosovo Central Fiscal Authority, UNMIK's tax service, and its customs service. The CFA and customs together collected 80% of the money that went into Kosovo's own budget. The CFA has now merged with Kosovo's Ministry of Finance. The creation of the CFA and the customs service is a great credit to Bernard Kouchner. You see, when UNMIK was given this enormous mandate, nobody had thought much about how to pay for its Kosovo costs. Bernard responded by creating institutions to raise money, the way all governments do, taxes and customs. Another example of matching the means to the mandate in Kosovo, Resolution 1244, has made UNMIC the ultimate authority. That gives us the power to carry out police investigations, the powers of arrest, and the authority to try suspects and imprison criminals. Not advisory powers, as international police in Bosnia had, but executive powers. Powers that are critical to meeting the challenge of our mission, achieving fundamental standards that apply to all functioning societies. Three, get it right from the beginning. The tone of the entire mission is set in its very first days. The beginning is no time for trial and error. It's critical to begin as you mean to go on. First, in order to establish credibility. Second, because it's much more difficult to correct course later on. Bosnia lacked the civil mandate and the means to begin strongly. Kosovo had the mandate but still lacked the means in the beginning. The mission in Bosnia was not front-loaded. The international community shied away from making Bosnia a protectorate. There were two reasons for this: the ideological legacy of decolonization and the terror of mission creep. When I arrived in Sarajevo in January 1996 alongside Carl Bildt, the most pressing problem was to reunify the city. Under the terms of Dayton, seven areas controlled by the Bosnian Serbs were to be returned to Bosnian government control. Though there was a lot of fear and confusion on both sides, many Bosnian Serbs were ready to stay in these areas and try to live again with their former neighbors. This posed a direct challenge to the logic of Bosnian Serb nationalism. Serb paramilitaries proceeded to force other Serbs to leave these areas and set fire to dozens of buildings. In this vacuum, there was looting on both sides. While this was going on, soldiers and police stood aside. Later, the international community had to invest enormous resources in undoing the damage inflicted in these few weeks. Kosovo, by contrast, was front-loaded, or so it seemed. We'd learned this much from Bosnia. But even in Kosovo, implementation was too slow. The military prepares in advance for crisis, and NATO was ready. But the civil mission in Kosovo only had 10 days to prepare. As the Brahimi report stresses, the UN's Department of Peacekeeping Operations must be given sufficient time and resources to respond quickly and efficiently to crises as they arise. As in Bosnia, some of the most difficult problems in Kosovo are the legacy of the mission's early days when UNMIC was operating with the skeleton staff. The summer and autumn of 1999 saw the most vicious reprisals, both among Kosovo Albanians and by the Albanian majority against Kosovo Serbs and members of other minority communities. Members of rival Albanian groups kidnapped, tortured, and murdered one another. People in Kosovo say there have been more Kosovo Serbs killed after the war than during it. Local politicians and former fighters struggled to fill the power vacuum. As a consequence, developing legitimate democratic institutions was delayed by the need to dismantle the structure that sprang up in the first 6 months. UNMIC didn't focus on organized crime at first because it didn't have the means. criminal gangs spread their tentacles in the political and legal vacuum. Starting in 2001, all the security forces shifted resources to organized crime. Both the police and justice improved their strategic cooperation with KFOR. Though more remains to be done, UNMIC's efforts against organized crime demonstrate the value of coordination and objective-driven policy. The creation of a group of Serbs who styled themselves the Bridge Watchers in northern Mitrovica also dated back to the very first day after KFOR and UNMIC arrived. Only last November was UNMIC finally able to assert its authority in the northern half of the city. 4, learn as you go. International missions need to be learning organizations. Critical to this is admitting we have made mistakes. You can't learn if you don't admit that you didn't do it right in the first place. Criticism will be more effective for the mission and less damaging politically if it comes from the mission itself rather than from outsiders. To be effective, missions must study the environment, its political rivalries and alliances, how people make a living, and the stories they tell one another. The mission needs to conduct public opinion surveys and consultations with the public in order to understand how people view their situation. Part of this is that the mission has to recognize what priorities are critical. Because of Kosovo's open status, it wasn't clear in the beginning whether UNMIC would or could engage in privatization. But UNMIC came to recognize that privatization was essential to putting Kosovo's economy on its feet. Last year, we created the Kosovo Trust Agency to conduct privatization of these strange titoist animals called socially owned enterprises, like the Peja Brewery, and reform publicly owned enterprises such as the Post. Just as we need to recognize our administrative limits, we must recognize our knowledge limits. We can never know everything, of course, but we need to learn to manage our ignorance. Key to this is to listen to the people and to seek their advice. It might seem banal, but in my experience, it's important to remember that no matter how hard we try, they know their own society better than we do. Lessons learned has become a bit of a buzzword. That doesn't mean everyone understands how to do it effectively. The lessons learned unit in the EU pillar of UNMIC offers an effective model. Being attached to the mission gives it access to information it needs. Being based on an NGO, the European Stability Initiative, gives it a critical degree of independence. To learn as it goes, a mission also needs to have a way to measure its achievements. That's one reason UNMIC created a list of 8 benchmarks or standards for measuring Kosovo's progress. These benchmarks cover the basic requirements for any functional democratic society: democratic institutions, the rule of law, a viable market-based economy, property rights, multi-ethnicity and return, freedom of movement. The point of writing them down in a list and publicizing it is to ensure that all relevant actors, the international community, UNMIC, Kosovo's institutions and civil society, are all singing from the same song sheet. On the international side, it will make it easier to identify both achievements and problems. On the Kosovo side, we hope the standards will help to concentrate people's minds on Kosovo's key challenges. 5, finish what you start. If the international community starts a peace-building mission, it has to stay until the society and its institutions are sustainable. Finishing what we start is critically important for two reasons. First, for the credibility of other peace-building missions. Second, because leaving business unfinished often plants the seeds of even worse conditions than the original intervention was meant to address. This seems obvious, but it runs directly counter to how governments operate. The problem is that peace building, although it must never be open-ended, is longer term, while political logic in individual governments is nearly always short term. Consequently, abandoning enterprises before their aims have been accomplished may be the most common mistake of the international community. Afghanistan provides a dramatic example of the folly of not finishing what you started. After years of supporting the Mujahideen, the anti-Soviet coalition abruptly abandoned Afghanistan. Rival warlords and the Taliban rushed into the vacuum that was only filled in the aftermath of 9/11. One of the reasons that measuring progress is so important is that we need to recognize when we should make the transition from peacekeeping to development. The core of the development stage is consolidating the rule of law and creating the institutions and regulations of a market economy. The important point here is that there is a lot of expertise in this area that is never applied to post-conflict areas. Peacekeepers are kept in a box marked peacekeeping, and developers are in a box marked development. Greece is a great EU success story. Its economy has soared since it began the accession process in the mid-70s. To achieve this progress, the European Union used very specific development tools: structural funds, 50-50 cooperation between international donors and locals, and public-private partnerships. Unlike candidates for accession, conflict areas are the domain of emergency funds rather than development economists. By recognizing when to make the transition from peacekeeping to development, regional organizations can apply the full range of their economic expertise to integrating the society into its respective regional economic system. The point of creating a yardstick like unmixed standards is to gauge when to make the transition from one stage to another and when the mission itself is no longer needed. And now, at the end, the tough ones. Principle 6 is about the right sequence, the essential sequence. It is security in law and law first, democratization later. First, a peace-building mission must establish order out of chaos. In this phase, the mission is in control of everything. Order means no discrimination, no violence, no bullying. This is the essential framework for democracy. The mission's first priority must be security and the rule of law. In Bosnia, we made a mistake by holding elections before establishing the rule of law. I remember how we agonized over whether to hold them just 6 months after Dayton. We had endless discussions about it, but we were driven to try it by unrealistic pressure to be out of Bosnia with everything done and dusted within a year. Within a year, and we are still there. While establishing security, The mission must respect human rights. As Sir Gerald Templer, High Commissioner of Malaya during the communist insurgency in 1948 observed, an administration must also follow its own laws. Consistently observing human rights and the law are essential for a mission's moral authority. Any idea, said Templer, that the business of normal civil government and the business of the emergency are two separate entities must be killed for good and all. The two activities are completely and utterly related. And Blaise Pascal observed, justice without force is powerless. Force without justice is tyranny. Next, we establish consent through information, dialogue, and participation. In this stage, regulations, laws, and an administrative framework are created. Effective institutions that deliver the key benefits of peace are an essential part of this. This must extend to all elements of the local population. Elections are vital, but they must come at the right time. Step three is to institutionalize consent for the established order so it sinks it into the society. Peaceful coexistence, democratic decision making, and conflict resolution must become habits. As Rousseau wrote, the strongest are still never sufficiently strong to ensure them continual mastership unless they find means of transforming force into right and obedience into duty. This is obviously a long-term process that is just beginning in Kosovo. A peace-building mission's endgame is to hand over all its responsibilities to a capable partner. It has only succeeded when it has made itself superfluous. This can only be achieved if you get the transition right. This is a mission's most critical and even volatile phase. Responsibilities have to be transferred gradually so that the society's institutions have the capacity to bear them. But it's hard to pace this process correctly. The problem is that once the transfer begins, unrealistic expectations are raised. This leads to impatience. Impatience, in turn, leads to friction. This is the stage we are now in Kosovo. This is exactly what I discussed with my colleagues at 9 this morning in Pristina in our executive committee meeting. The 3.5 years we've had are a short time to build all the institutions of society from the ground up, but they are a long time in human lives. As in South Africa, many people hoped that deliverance from their oppressors would mean immediate improvement on all fronts. They were impatient. We are working with our partners in Kosovo to transfer responsibilities as quickly as they are able to handle them. Thousands of political representatives and civil servants are under pressure to learn quickly. On our part, this requires continuous consultations, sensitivity, and consistency. In this phase, the ongoing support of the international community is especially imperative. In responding to the tensions of the transfer phase, it's critical for the international community to avoid sending mixed signals, and vital to speak with one voice. 7, peace building means changing bad habits, however traditional they may be. I said earlier that peace building does not mean creating clones of Western European societies. Clearly, a range of traditions is consistent with sustainable stability. but not all are. Peace builders have to abandon the pretension that they are neutral. Yes, we must be impartial, but this does not mean being neutral. We must accept that the process of change from violence to peace is a struggle in which we have to take sides. We don't choose among those who support the process, but we support those who are for the peace process and oppose those who are against it. We also have to try to change general attitudes that may appear to be traditional, if in reality they are only holding the society back. For example, corruption and cronyism. Corruption may have been practiced since time immemorial, but it retards the development of any society. The empowerment of women has been shown to be perhaps the most reliable single predictor of overall social political development. In most parts of the world, women have limited access to education and employment. Knowing what we know, international missions should not hesitate to change this wherever they can. The willingness to change bad habits, however, does not mean forcing change on a society. Far from it. Change is not a one-way lecture, but a dynamic process of mutual learning. The international community brings its experience to a community that wants to leave conflict behind and enjoy the fruits of peace. The peace-building mission must also learn from the local community to understand its values and ways of doing things. The point here is that building peace doesn't allow us to run away from the hard challenges just because they are deeply rooted. When we finish a mission, we have to leave a healthy and self-sustaining society behind us. Otherwise, weeds will grow back and entangle us for years to come. Finally, the art of letting go. UNMIC will not be the last international effort to build up a peaceful society amid the ashes of war. Indeed, it seems likely that such efforts in various shapes and sizes will be part of our future. No one can be pleased to see the expanding number of candidates for international intervention. But the good news is that we have demonstrated that peace building is not an exercise in futility, as some have argued. It is instead a manageable human enterprise subject to the determined application of certain basic principles. When looking at a conflict, the international community can legitimately decide whether or not to intervene. Clearly, we cannot intervene everywhere. But if we do, we have to be serious about it and follow it through. As I've said, when it comes to peace building, this means adhering to tested principles. First, a mission must go in with a clear mandate. Second, it must have the authority and resources to do the job. Third, it must get it right from the beginning. Fourth, it must learn from the host society and from its own mistakes. Fifth, it must finish what it starts and the two hard ones. Sixth, it must first establish security and the rule of law as the framework for democratization. Seventh, it must change the host society's bad habits, even if they are traditional. Ladies and gentlemen, a peace operation is only finished when it has handed over its responsibilities, making itself superfluous. This is the art of letting go. Success is when we are gone. It's about handing over responsibilities, not clinging to them. We should build up the importance of those to whom we need to hand over. Letting go is not easy, but in the end, our success is their success. For future peace operations, we have a rich store of experience and an excellent storekeeper in Jean-Marie Guéhenno, the head of UN peacekeeping. But we must apply the lessons of our experience. This takes endurance. Whether we can do it depends on political will. Unlike our collective knowledge, political will does not build up but tends to evaporate after every crisis. But political will and our belief in our own abilities are closely connected. Where we know there is a way, there is more likely to be the will. Thank you.
Very much indeed for a very thoughtful and self-reflective talk. And far from being boring, as I looked at everybody's faces, they all seemed completely riveted. So thank you very much. We have half an hour for questions. So who would like? And what I suggest is, could you say who you are? Because it helps in answering. Yes.
Well, my name is Donald Davis, private citizen. Two and a half years ago, obviously, when the Allied forces moved into Kosovo, but I was thinking, well, what next? So I heard rumours in the press about a referendum on independence for Kosovo. Well, that was 2.5 years ago. 1 year ago, there were elections for Kosovo Assembly, so I thought, you know, some signs of movement there. And since then, I've really heard nothing. So,
what's your question?
Well, so what is the future of Kosovo?
Okay. Now, that's an absolutely legitimate question. I have to tell you one thing. What we call the international community, incorporated in the Security Council and other institutions, what you described as a phenomenon, they feared it very much. When the Assembly was established, many people feared that the first act of the Assembly would be the declaration of independence, which obviously would make things maybe more difficult. I think it's very clear what the big majority of the Kosovars want. They want to have independence. Our policy, we need also to know that the minority, I'm talking about the Kosovo Serb minority, wants exactly the opposite. So we have a problem. And the fact is that 1244, our Bible, has not resolved this problem, has put it in the end. And as I said before, that's the big difference between Bosnia and Kosovo. In Bosnia, we had Dayton. It's a peace agreement. Then we walked in. In Kosovo, we have first us walking in, and then in the end having a solution to the most problematic issue, the final status issue. Now, our line was, what can we do in a situation where obviously the solution of the final status would be a problem in itself, either on this side or on the other side. So that's why we said last year, in looking at the challenges we have on the ground, standards before status. That means, let us first transform the reality in Kosovo by having reliable institutions, by having freedom of movement, by having return, by having judges which function, by having a parliament which protects certain rights. So that you change the situation on the ground first, and then it would be much easier to have the most difficult issue address the final status. Now, we have a change in the situation, in the overall situation. When the mission was established, judging from the experiences from Bosnia and other places, and I'm not talking about Cyprus, but other places, the feeling in each and every capital, including London, was this is something for a very, very long time. So in 1999, in summer, the idea was there's a long breath for this change of society. Now, I must say that it is very clear that one of the effects of September 11 is that the time perspectives we have for ongoing peacekeeping mission has radically changed. And I think that in Kosovo, we don't have 10 years or 12 years to address the very question you have mentioned. We have less time. The hope what we have is that in order to protect the investment which we have done in Kosovo, not only financially, also by human resources and politically, that we have the ongoing support that over the next, I hope, years, and I think we will have years, but not many years, we will can consolidate the situation on the ground so that this society is capable, what is already written in 1244 now. 1244 talks anyhow about a substantial autonomy, a substantial self-rule. Now, if you want to have a substantial self-rule, you need to have institutions, a government, parliament, who can handle this task. In a situation like Kosovo, where you had nothing, I mean, where we started from chaos, where you don't have a democratic tradition as you would have it here in Great Britain. So what I'm trying to say is I don't know when it comes. I don't know how it will look like, the final status. The only thing what I could say is what it cannot look like. It cannot be a return to the status quo ante. This is excluded, with or without Milosevic. This is gone. I think this possibility has been lost by the policy of Milosevic. This is gone. We cannot go back to the past. But how exactly the future will look like is an open question and is not really the real question. The real question is, I mean, the most pressing issue in Kosovo, apart from security and organized crime and corruption, what is the most pressing issue? It's the jobless rate, the unemployment. Varying numbers we have, but it's surely 56%, 56% of a society where over 50% are younger than 25 years. If these people don't have a perspective down there, I mean, they simply go. And the bright people will go, of course. They will go to Germany, to Switzerland, to Great Britain. And in order to avoid that, I think it is fair to say, let's first create a society which somehow can function, and then let's then address the final status. But it's true, we have not much time. And the more we go on, somehow we are haunted by our progress, the more we go on, the more pressing this issue will be. And we have a situation, and I stop with that in a minute, but it's very interesting. So far, the Kosovo Albanians were the ones who have always called for, as quickly as possible, independence. Now we have Djindjic. Djindjic says exactly the opposite. That's the prime minister in Belgrade. He has changed completely the course of Belgrade in the recent weeks, and he says now, let's address the final status quickly, because what they're doing there in Kosovo, by establishing these functioning institutions, they're going de facto in a creeping way towards independence. So we are in a situation now that Belgrade says, we want this to be settled, we want this to be out of the way, we want the status settled of Kosovo. And the Kosovo Albanians say that too. And we are saying, allow me to say that, but I really feel that also from having been on the weekend at the countryside talking to people. We are addressing the issues which are really in the interest of the people. That means the jobs, the corruption, the crime, the infrastructure, the freedom of movement, the functioning of the institutions. So that's the problem we have in the moment. And this is why I said also, in this volatile phase, it is so important that you are continued to be supported by the international community. And there we have the problem of this beauty contest that now everybody, including you, are shifting your attention to Iraq. And we are out there and have still to finish this job. Oh, can I mention one point? Sorry. Because I haven't addressed it here, not expressly. There's one big point which nobody in Kosovo seems to really care of, but which is the crucial point. And that is the concretization of the European perspective. I mean, Karin, do we have this map here? You know, I have drawn a map on the future geography of Europe. That's an ideological map. And this, I don't know whether you can see that, but I explain. The blue thing is the European Union. And when Bulgaria and Romania are part of the European Union, they're candidates, and they will be part, then you will see that the Balkan is in fact an island, is in fact an enclave within the European Union. And that means that the European Union, whether they want it or not, cannot avoid in addressing this issue more seriously. And on the other hand, equally important is, of course, and I think this is the only long-term chance for these countries in the Balkans, and that's true for Kosovo as for other places, that they have a concrete perspective towards Europe. If they don't have that, I don't see how we can address these enormous problems, unemployment, the biggest priority, without this concrete perspective, drawing on the good lessons we had in Portugal, Spain, or Greece, or elsewhere. Sorry, next one is shorter.
Doesn't matter. Jadranka.
Thank you very much for raising some of the very important issues here. You talk about getting the sequence right, and you said security and the rule of law first, democratization later. Isn't the real challenge to actually do and run parallelly all these efforts which are, and isn't really the rule of law an essential part of democratization?
No, but that's what I said, security and rule of law, and then you come to the democratization. What I want to say by that is, in Bosnia we had the situation that those very leaders who have been waging the war, on the positive or negative, I don't judge them now. They were in power. We came in with a mandate to implement Dayton, very ambitious goals in the constitution, very complicated but also ambitious, especially when it comes to the rule of law and human rights provisions. But we did this, and in parallel we had the old leaders who have been responsible for the war or couldn't hinder it. So what I'm trying to say is we need a timeout, and we have done this in Kosovo more or less successfully. You need to establish yourself when you come in this chaotic situation. It's not a normal situation. Everything breaks down. The morality, everything breaks down. So in such a situation, what you need first to establish the ground rules, and don't have the old party allegiances ongoing. So you need a certain timeout, establish the rule of law as good as you can, have, of course, ideally the civil society on your side. They would tell you the same, by the way, for a certain time. And then you have elections, and then you need to withdraw. I think the worst thing is if you go half-hearted in, and then you stay and stay and stay. You need to have a plan. You go in, do it fully, then have elections, and then hand over as quickly as you can. But don't have the two systems parallelly, so that you go in, you say, oh, we don't want to interfere too much, and then the old structures, which had been responsible for the outbreak of the war, for all the atrocities, continue to exercise their powers. So you're right with rule of law, absolutely essential, but also security. But this you need to establish, and once you have it, then you let loose and hand over. I think that's important. If you mix these two things up, it's not clear. Think also about the people. When we had the first elections in Bosnia, they voted, of course, along ethnic lines. Why did they do that? Mostly out of fear, because they had the fear the other side is still in power, and we don't know how long the international community, there was no change. So first you need to establish, we are talking about a situation where you have a complete chaos. Everything is broken down. Only these old power structures are there. So this probably you need to first break, but then also leave, and not this agonizing going on and on parallels. But rule of law, I agree fully with you.
Now I can see lots of hands. I think I'll take three at once, and then I'll take another three. So the gentleman right up there at the back, who I saw first.
Thanks very much. My name is David O'Sullivan. I just basically was writing down a few points. I was quite gobsmacked by your...
What is that? Got?
Quite, quite speechless. By your fourth point of your seven principles, when you say learn as you go, I'm sure history has got an awful lot of lessons which has to be learnt first, rather than empiricism, which is a very dangerous blunt tool. I mean, from if you go back,
what's your question?
The question is, how do you justify creating smaller and smaller statelets or autonomous little regions under conditions whereby you said 56% unemployment. Under what conditions are these people going to be living under, where the major powers are going to dominate the economies of these countries? The people are going to be basically cheap labour platforms, and that's what's going to be set up in these areas. Am I right or not?
Okay, I'll take two more and then Michael can answer. There's a lady here who's had her arm just behind your drinker.
Hello, Jeta Jara from Kosovo. My favorite of your rules of peace building was to get it right. And I was just wondering, will fixing the electricity somewhere fall on the banner of getting it right? Because you didn't mention it at all, and it seems, as a Kosovan, is one of the most crucial issues. Before you think of peace building in the morning, you think of turning the lights on. That's first. Second, it's got to do with the same standards before status, and I'm talking about standards. Do you think that you interpreted the getting the standards right before status as something that is good for Kosovo itself to do, to fulfill all these conditions, but other people interpret it as something that will actually, as a side effect of it, will be that it will leave Kosovo in a limbo as far as let's say economy. Like, people will not invest precisely because it's a limbo of you don't know who's got responsibility for where the money goes, who's the state, basically. So this is also in the same time as it the time to fulfill the standards for any status. It will also be not so benefiting for Kosovo, it will damage it. So why do you think in the end that is so good to leave so many years, when it could be very well, collateral damage of it could be that it would be a damage to Kosovo? Yeah, yeah.
Can you? And then, can I what? Shall I just take one more?
Okay.
The gentleman there.
Thank you. David Buchan, Financial Times. Just two quick questions. One is that I've forgotten what my first question was. I'll go to my second question. My second question was your vision of Kosovo. What can you just give us your ultimate vision of what it will be? Surely it will be independent. And my first question is the issue. You said that 9/11 had shortened the timetable. Could you just the international forces in Kosovo and maybe the Balkans, could you just elaborate a little bit on that? Why?
Okay. Now, on the lessons learned, I mean, the decision how the landscape in the Balkans ultimately will look like, I think, does not depend on changing the situation on the ground, on bringing back 900,000 refugees, on establishing freedom of movement, on establishing, and we have defects here still, a multi-ethnicity and so on. I think that is not the point. I mean, this tendency was set before. It was not set by the peacekeepers. The peacekeepers came in the end. So when I talk about lessons learned, I'm talking about the lessons learned from peacekeeping. I don't think that you can say, because this might create statelets, you shouldn't do peacekeeping. So I'm talking here about peacekeeping. This is the first point. Second point is electricity. I mean, I tell you something, I couldn't agree more with you. Now, let me just straighten out some facts. We have KEK, that's the Kosovo Electricity Producing Company, coal producing company, it's a dinosaur from the past. It is, I call it always, an old Sastava. You know, these old cars you had there in Yugoslav Titoist times. It was completely worn out. The blocks A, we have blocks A and block B. The blocks A are 30 years old, completely rotten. And every economist would tell you, close that. We have newer block Bs, 20 years old, equally rotten, equally not functioning. One element. And we are talking about the situation when we came in 99, Kushner came in and others, what the situation was. The second point is, you must bear in mind that the electricity consumption now is much, much higher than it was in 99, than it was even before the war, because we have, and that's a success, some economic activity, not as we would like it, but we have a much higher electricity consumption. So we have more demand, but a rotten system. And I didn't even talk about the distribution system, which we have there, which is equally rotten, and all the security devices are also rotten. So everything is completely rotten in this place. No. If you want, for a place like Kosovo with 2 million inhabitants, if you want to have the electricity provided, it costs you about 1.2, 1.4 billion euros investment. That's what we're talking about, to have it new, which would be the best thing. But the problem was, we were in 99. To build a new electricity site there, producing site, which you can because we have this lignite, we have the coal, we have the resources there. But it takes you 5 to 6 years to build that. You cannot build that immediately. You need to have an investor, you need the money, and it's quite an enormous amount of money, and you need time for building this up. So what was the problem we had? In 99, we had to provide electricity for the winter. So what went in was the money, mostly the Europeans, by the way, have provided all in all in CEC and invested in CEC, and that is €500 million, which is a lot of money, which is a lot of money. So this has been put in to keep the Sastava running. That's what happened, more or less. By the way, last time I was in Croatia, I tell you, I was also in the shower, and the light went off, and I tell you, it's rather awkward even in Croatia. And it happens, I mean, it happens also in other places, but it's very bad in Kosovo, I will not deny that. But I tell you the situation the people were in. Now, we thought, when I came into Kosovo in February, of course this was my first issue, I mean, what the hell is this with the electricity? And they explained me how this thing there went, and maybe also mistakes, I will not deny this, but in principle that was the challenge. But they told me, in summer we have it. We will have 90% even in winter when it's very cold. And then what happened? In June, lightning strike. It was a lightning strike. I tell you, it was a lightning strike. It was not a crime, it was not a SERP, it was not corruption, it was a lightning strike. And this lightning strike has taken out two-thirds of the capacity we had in June. Two-thirds. Listen, if it had killed Sastava, you would have no electricity at all. That is our problem. So what we had to do, against all the rules of the UN, I tell you, if the UN would know, the headquarters would know what we really have done there, because we had no concurrence, we had to repair, urgently repair. And people were running for 24 hours to repair it more or less. Now we are in a situation that we have four on, two off, something like that. Sometimes it's even better, sometimes it's less. It's not so bad. We avoided a catastrophe just to get over the winter. But now comes the hard challenge. I tell you what the hard challenge is. We have 10,000 people working in CEC. This is surely half too many. Half we have to send out, we have to pay, we have to have a social plan there, we have to avoid a social crisis with these people. Because also if you send them out, don't think that the Sastava becomes safer if people are angry and have to leave the place. So this is one problem. Secondly, we need to have the money, we need to have an investor, we need to have someone who is ready to invest, but not only in 5 years to have a new nice site, but also in the meantime. You need to have the money for that. And in order to get the money, you need the international side, but you have also the need for another partner. And here comes the other problem, and that is energy saving. I tell you one thing. In June, we have set up an energy committee, as we called it, together with the government. Recepi was on the other side. We had this energy committee planning how we get over the winter with this situation. And the government has taken over the responsibility to have an energy savings campaign. Now, don't underestimate that, because the most electricity you can produce by saving energy. You had this here in Great Britain after 73. You had quite an efficient energy saving campaign. I tell you, nothing happened. And the people don't know how to use electricity because they haven't it there. Second thing is, they need to pay for the electricity because otherwise you cannot repair the place. So all this we have to do at the same time. And I tell you, I have found in a Bavarian beer garden in August someone who has been the director of a lignite company in east of Germany who had several similar problems. He was down there 2 weeks after. He's still down there, and he's the interim director. He does nothing than that. He has to reform this whole company. We need to have profit centers, of course. We need to have the coal production out. We have to reduce the personnel because you cannot pay them. We have to make this thing more efficient and at the same time prepare an investment for the future. We have to make the consumers pay electricity, and we have to make them aware that electricity is not for nothing. So that's a lot of things to do, and of course there are shortcomings, that's true, but in somehow this is a picture of the whole society we have. We have mental peacekeeping, I haven't mentioned it. It's not only the physics. You need to do a lot also with these people who are traumatized. I mean, under the surface of their skin, 1 millimeter under, all the horrors of the war are there, also with the minorities. So they're traumatized, these people. Still, they have not overcome the experiences of the former socialist system. And all this gives you a conglomerate where I would tell you it's not so easy, believe me.
What about the questions from the Financial Times?
Oh, yes. I mean, you will not hear from me because, you know, I still want to do this job for a while. I will. What the outcome will be. And I think I would dare to dare the thesis, it is not so important. I think it is more important to change the situation on the ground than the final status. I think if we have a more or less respected society, of course we will not have Switzerland. It must be under the given circumstances in the surrounding. A more or less respected society, it will be much easier to address in a rational way the status without new bloodshed, without new refugees leaving in masses the place or rivalries under groups. So it would be wrong even to prejudge this outcome where I think the way is more important than the outcome in the end. And the way must be that the guys from Pristina, those who want to have more responsibility, those who want to take their own future in their own hand, they must be ready to talk to the guys in Belgrade. They need first to talk. Nobody should have a veto. In the end, it will end up with the Security Council. But we need to have this civilized way of addressing a problem which is not only for the Kosovans to decide, because it has to do something with the situation in the region. In the end, we might come there that one has to take a decision, which will clearly be substantial self-rule, whatever form. This is more important to have this way and to change the situation on the ground than prejudging the question of the final outcome, because it doesn't. I mean, your point, let us have the final status and then everything becomes easy. That is wrong, because final status means if you want to have a large autonomy, you need international partners. You need partners in the European Union, you need partners in the world. You will only have these partners with enough sympathy if you can say we have done our share, we treat our minorities correctly and so on. Only then will you be able to interact. And what is more important, if you want to have large, substantial autonomy, you need to have institutions who are able to carry out these functions. So we need first to create these functions. I'm not talking about 10 years. I'm just talking about having time enough that the provisional government, that the assembly really are capable of doing this job, which is not talking window dressing, which is very concrete, which are very concrete issues. And what concerns September 11, I think it's very easy. I mean, before this time, which might look for us now in retrospect even idyllic, this time until September, you had the whole international community, the capitals, maybe less, but still very much concentrated on the Balkans and on Kosovo, that this undertaking, this common undertaking, is a success. Of course, this is not the case anymore. And if we cannot say to Washington, to other capitals, who look, of course, are involved in the fight against international terrorism, there is a light at the end of the tunnel. We don't plan this for doing it forever, for the next 12 years, for a generation, but we have a concept, a structured way forward, then we will get this ongoing engagement, also financial engagements. Otherwise, we will not get it. So what I'm saying is the fact that we have the world attention shifted to other issues since September 11 means also that we have less time to fulfill our job and have to really hurry up. But over this process of hurrying up, it's very important that we still finish the job. I mean, to leave Kosovo as a place where we engaged ourselves and then withdraw ourselves and forget it because there's no bloodshed would be the worst thing, because all the money we have invested there would be at risk. All the energy we have invested there and all the politics. And after all, it's part of Europe. And if anyone has the idea that you can build around the Balkans or Kosovo a fence and say, let them develop as they want, we do Europe, this will not work. This does not work. I mean, you will have the immediate repercussions of crime and other issues automatically, whether you like it or not, if you don't take on the responsibility for this place. They have to take on theirs, but I think they need partners in the European Union for our own interests.
Gosh, all these hands and we're running out of time. Is it okay if we take two more? So I'll take you in the middle because you've been having your arm up.
Hi, my name is Merton Krasnici. You did mention UMNIC's fourth pillar with a clear objective to build EU viable, compatible economy, viable market economy. You did mention Kushner that brought about customs and excise, taxes, finances and stuff. In Kosovo, we only have small businesses that is going to absorb all the unemployment you mentioned. However, all the tax system is stacked against small businesses. VAT or equivalent of VAT kicks in at 15% at zero turnover. In England, VAT kicks in at 17.5% at £50,000 turnover. Anything above 7,000 euros turnover in a month is added 3%. As you know, VAT cripples small businesses. It adds to the administrative burden on a business and it doesn't help. It's much cheaper for Kosovan people to buy ready-made products abroad rather than to buy packages and produce homegrown products.
Yeah.
I'll take one more and then you can answer them. I'm just looking around. I can see so many arms. The lady right up there. I was thinking when you were talking about electricity that when I was in Kosovo in the summer of 99, one of my friends said to me it would be too much happiness to have electricity and water and freedom. Yeah, go ahead.
Yes, Gordon Eglich, IWPR. I have one question about the recent murder of Takri Zemai and the serial of the murders of LDK officials in Paz. First of all, do you qualify them as the political murders? And what exactly UNMIC and judiciary and police, of course, do to solve out all these mysterious murders? Exactly how many investigations? Is any perpetrator punished until now?
Yeah, okay.
And if I may, I'd like to add a question. You talked about changing the situation on the ground in order to pave the way for a final solution. But isn't one of the problems that the last few years have consolidated a partition between Serb areas and the rest of Kosovo?
Okay. That is linked also to what, in the end, the future Kosovo will look like. I think there is an interrelationship between the logic of partition and what we are doing and what they are doing, the Kosovans. The international community came in on the defense of fundamental human rights, the protection of the weak against the stronger. Now, if we now, as an end result of our engagement, would have a solution that we have partition, that would mean that we would have mono-ethnicity, because partition means mono-ethnicity. The Serbs would go there, and the Kosovo Albanians would go there. Furthermore, we would have done it for the first time. And secondly, if you start this dangerous job of partitioning in one place, very difficult to stop it in another place. So you have to think about Bosnia, you have to think about Macedonia and all the consequences. It's a very dangerous thing to do. But the best argument against partition we cannot deliver. The Kosovo majority can deliver that. If the institutions, first and foremost the assembly, if in the reality in the streets and in the cities, we could say or we could experience that minority protection works in the assembly, in freedom of movement, in return, then you have the best argument that partition makes no sense. Partition makes only sense if those who advocate partition can say it doesn't work. So that's why I'm saying the guys who are sitting in the parliament, they have every national interest, how they call it, national interest to make the parliament meticulously respect all the provisions which protect minorities. They have an interest, a proper interest, if they want to keep Kosovo together, that freedom of movement is also delivered to the smaller communities and that they are protected and that they can return. Zemai? No, we don't have indications that it is political. But of course, I mean, I would call it, it's, you know, one dark guy or some dark guys kill someone who is not necessarily, I mean, you know, the exemplary of what you would portray for your children as follow this guy. So a bit complicated. What I want to say is it is part, and this event has been part of the darker side of Kosovo, no doubt, no doubt. Now, I think that the police, because we have a number of testimonies, normally we don't have this so easily because of the wall of silence, we have quite some good indications, so it might well be that we can bring a light to this specific incident. Don't forget, 80% is the rate of clearing the responsibility in murder cases, so we are not so bad, better than in a number of Western societies. So we have a chance. We have a chance there that this incident is cleared. Now, for me, the best proof that organized crime and these rather sinister guys take the anti-crime efforts we are undertaking, which are integrated efforts between the international police and the local police, seriously, is the most recent rocket-propelled. Propelled rocket, or how do you call that, which has been sent against our police, or thrown against our police station in Pečpeja. They did this because they're nervous. I think that we have a number of arrests which have provoked also protests under some people. We have a number of successes here, not enough, by far not enough, which are quite spectacular. So I think not overnight, and we need to have this ongoing support from the international side, but I think we make there some progress. This is also why it's so important that in politically sensitive cases, and I'm not talking specifically about Semai, it is important that we have international judges because you can imagine there are some quite some pressures on the judicial system otherwise. Then what concerns the tax system? I have mentioned the CFA, means our fiscal authority. In the beginning, when the society is not yet structured, you get, the easiest way to get money is at the borders and boundaries. So this is why 80% of the local income we had was via customs. But you are absolutely right. This cannot work in the long term, and we will shift this to other forms of taxes. This is why we are, for example, now propagating and starting to conclude free trade agreements with all the neighbors. We have started it with Albania, we start this now with Croatia, and we'll do it with other places. But generally, what concerns the tax system we have in Kosovo, we have also one advantage. You know, in my former capacity, I've seen how long it took Gerhard Schröder to change the pension law, which we had to change because of the different demographic situation in our societies. Just a slight little new paragraph has taken him 3 years to convince the different political factors. We are in a different situation. We do things from scratch on, so we can have very modern systems. And we have it also, by the way, in the tax system. Our taxes are, apart from the problems we have at the borders, which we are now trying to overcome, which you rightly mentioned, with the consequences you have mentioned, that it's easier to buy imports than produce things within Kosovo. But we have the lowest taxes you have anywhere in Europe. Our tax rates are also for entrepreneurs exceptionally low. So in principle, this is not the problem. We have to overcome some legacies at the borders and boundaries. There, you're right.
Well, thank you very much. I think we do have to come to an end now. But thank you all for being a wonderful audience. Let me just make a couple of announcements. One is that our program also produces something called the Global Civil Society Yearbook, and you can buy it outside. The second is, can you let us go out first? Thank you.
Thank you, everybody.